Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Founders Day, once a year. We honor the people who made this temple possible, two of them. And we're going to fold in a third one today. So, when you start practice in a place like this, one of the strangest things you encounter is chanting this long list of names that just seems so strange. This almost endless list of foreign names, hard to pronounce, hard to chant. It's pretty repetitive, it's pretty confusing. Who the heck are these people? How can they possibly be relevant to what brings us here today? And it's not pure history. Some of the people that we chant in the ancestral line may not have existed at all, at least not as single people. Some of them are combined from individuals. Those who did exist might be more separated in time than the lineage chant implies. There may be gaps that are not acknowledged. And it's certainly not complete. There are so many people lost to history who had important roles to play in bringing the tradition forward. So it's kind of an odd thing to chant, but at the same time, it's just fundamental truth. The real people with real life problems who were not at all unlike us. You think, how could this be relevant to me? But if you read their stories, you understand that these people dealt with the same struggles that we deal with. They have pride, they have shame, they have stress of various kinds. They overcame obstacles in ways similar to how we overcame them. And there's something identical given forward. We use the word transmission, which is unfortunate in some ways because it implies that something is given and received, but what it means is something is awakened and recognized. Something that everyone has. Maybe you could call it an understanding or a view of reality, but it is the same from that first name to that last name. That's part of what we're recognizing when we chant these names, is that something comes to us today from Shakyamuni more than 2,500 years ago, and it is the same. At the same time, we get told not to copy others, right? One thing that brings us in the door is we see somebody who has something we want. They have a composure or a peace of mind or a confidence that we lack and we want it. And so we do what they do. We try what they've tried. And then we encounter various things in the literature that tells us not to copy others. To the Kyoju Kaimon, to do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world. Well, now, if you become an example to the world, doesn't that mean someone should copy you? This gets really confusing. It's fine. You start out copying. We learn, we practice finding what is ours to do here. So all the aspects of lineage and studying of our ancestors can be confusing in lots of ways. So today is Founders Day, and we celebrate my teacher's teacher, Jiyu Kennett, the first one next to the altar, and her teacher, Kato Chisan. And since Jiyu Kennett was still alive when Dharma Rain was founded, we don't count Kyogen as a founder because he founded this temple on her behalf, even though he is now gone and we think of him as one of our founders. He's not sort of technically in Soto Shu terms a founder. I'm going to talk about him though. As time goes on, there are only a very few of us that ever met Jiyu Kennett, still in the temple here. And those of us who knew Kyogen are pretty much fading fast. He died 14 years ago, and a lot of people in the room today never met him. So we've been thinking about how do we in the truest sense, transmit our history and our tradition to new generations. And one way we're going to do that is to offer a talk about our founders, all three of them, now and then, so that people literally know some history of how this came to be. So you're going to get a little bit of a history lecture today, among other things. Kato Chisan. You might have seen a picture of him that is in the office of him smiling beside Dwight D. Eisenhower. He met Eisenhower. Kato means bright hall, and Koho means orphan peak. We use generation names here when we become disciples, and those who take vows with the same teacher in the same generation use the same, essentially, family name. So my generation used the name Kato. So my name is actually Kato Jiko. So I get to reach back to my grandfather, great-grandfather in the Dharma as part of my name. And my students use Koho. So we keep reaching back. So Kato Chisan was born right in the middle of the Meiji Restoration, 1868 to 1912. That's when Japan went through an enormous upheaval, opened to the West, many fundamental conventions of society and governance were turned upside down and questioned and changed. It's one of the most dramatic periods in all of Japanese history. Government changed, foreign language changed, clothing changed, marriage, industry, everything changed. Definitely religion changed. The shogunate, the shoguns, were removed and the emperor was brought back to power. And that new government wanted to stop Buddhist practice because the Buddhists didn't recognize the emperor as divine. So they wanted to eliminate some of that power. So they tried a lot of things. Shinto was re-elevated, Buddhism was officially discouraged. There was some violence against temples. All the various schools were told to combine, but they all individually refused to do that. And the rules for the priesthood changed in ways that still reverberate today. Celibacy was ended. Marriage was encouraged among priests. Meat eating was allowed. So it really changed the nature of the priesthood. There were some good things. There was a new education system developed. The lay Buddhists had new influence because the priests lost some power. And the lay people really kept the temples open. And meditation was elevated to a more central place, and it was offered more broadly. So Kato Chisan was born into this world of radical change and radical uncertainty. He ordained at the age of 10. He was transmitted by Koho Hakugan, who adopted him and added the name Koho. Not an unusual pattern. Kato Chisan got a university education and eventually became the 32nd head of Raigaku-ji and served as abbot for 50 years. So he had quite a long tenure at Raigaku-ji. But while he was doing that, while he was running this large temple, he was the director of the Kamazawa University Library. He was a teacher, he was a principal, he was a military chaplain, and he was part of the upper administration of Soto Zen. And he wrote 4 books. So he was a busy guy. He kept going. And then in 1957, he became the 18th abbot of what we call Daihonzan Sojiji, Sojiji in Yokohama, one of the 2 main training temples for Sotoshu. He didn't give up any of his other jobs, he just added one more gigantic job to his life. One of the things we remember about him, that we honor about him, was how politically deft this guy was. He was renowned all his life for being kind and gentle. And yet he threaded the needle through this incredibly complex and changing time. One of the things he championed above all others was education of children and opportunities of practice for women. He was the first one to have the monastery offer education to orphans, particularly girls. So those monks added that job to their lives. They started teaching little girls. And all through his life, he worked to open up women's roles in the Soto Shu. And of course, he was Jiyu Kennett's teacher, and I'll get to that. So this guy, this gentle, kind, easygoing guy, received full Soto certification, full Rinzai certification, and was given the title Foremost Great Teacher of Scriptures. Kind of incredible how much he accomplished, really. He was never idle. He had a very rigorous commitment to meditation practice, to formal study. And he still kept a little garden and a little koi pond. And he puttered in his garden every day by his little house. So all of this radical reformation that he did in a very quiet, very calm way. Just going to read. There's not much of his work in English, but this is one. His introduction to the thought of the Serene Reflection Meditation School of Buddhism. So thinking of where this guy came from, he says, religion in feudal society is necessarily feudal. In democratic society, it must be democratic. But in modern religion, feudal vestiges still remain fairly strong. We must gradually sweep these vestiges away and return to the true form of religion, in which the aspect of the religious experience of the founder himself will come to the fore. Religion is not something for a special group of people. It is found deep in the heart of all people. The world of religion does not discriminate against the dull in favor of the wise, nor does it draw distinctions between men and women, clergy and lay people. It must break the narrow confines of nationality and spread its doctrine throughout the world. Yeah, and he goes on for quite some time, and then he starts talking about how we have to accept scientific truth and study the ways of the world. So, Kato Chisan had 20 Dharma heirs, including Jiyu Kennett. He died at Sojiji in 1967 on November 1st. Because he died on All Hallows Day in the West, Jiyu Kennett moved Founders Day to be adjacent to Halloween, and we follow this tradition today. It wouldn't necessarily have been then, but she saw the connection there. So, in 1997, a group of us went to Japan because Raigakuji, where he'd been abbot for 50 years, had been remodeled and was being rededicated, and we went for that ceremony, among other things. Kyogen and Gyokuko were with us. I think a few others in this room were too. Mikio was, Sokyo was, Sosetsu was there, some others. And we went to Sojiji. It's a really impressive property. It's a huge property with beautiful grounds. It's open to the public. These days, they're quite friendly. They have a website. They offer tours, vegetarian meals. They give Zazen instruction. But it was a little more enclosed and formal in 1997. What I remember, among other things, is that we had an hour-long ceremony in which we had to kneel on tatami mats with no benches. And it was very challenging for the Westerners to be in that posture for an hour. But there were 200 monks chanting, and it was magic. It was just a magical ceremony. But what Kyogen took away was the hall with the portraits of all the prior abbots. typical part of temples is to have an array of portraits of former abbots, all the historical leaders. And at Sojiji, there was this long line of serious scowling, fierce-looking abbots, and Kato Chisan with a big grin. And it just really stood out that that's our guy, you know. He was different. So then in 1960, Kato Chisan traveled around the world. He was celebrating what he called the commemoration of 100 years of friendship between Japan and America. That's Meiji Restoration talk. And he met President Eisenhower, and in a very old Eastern tradition, he asked President Eisenhower for permission to teach Zen in the United States. It was granted. They shook hands, and the president said he could teach in the United States. Then Kato Chisan went to London. At that time, a woman named Peggy Kennett was part of the London Buddhist Society, which was a Rensei group that had been established by D.T. Suzuki some time before. So when Kato Chisan arrived, she was assigned to be his jisha, and she was 36 years old at that time. She'd had a good education. She had an advanced degree in traditional music, medieval music forms, which you heard a little bit of this morning when we sang Vespers, the Litany of the Great Compassionate One. She composed the music for that. And before he left, she asked him to ordain her. They had one of those meetings where they just met. They just completely met. And he said, if she's serious about ordaining, she has to come to Japan and train in his monastery. Now, it's 1960. This just isn't done. Not women, not foreigners. So it takes 2 years of arranging, but after 2 years of that, of struggling to make it happen, she gets on a boat that goes through the Suez Canal to Sri Lanka and Malaysia. Now, she didn't know what was happening at the time, and we still aren't really sure why it happened this way, but she ends up in Malaysia and is ordained in the Chinese Rinzai tradition. Huge fanfare because she's a Western woman. And she's like, this isn't really what I was planning to do. So she's already ordained when she gets to Japan, but not in the lineage she wanted. Anyway, she finds her way on to Sojiji, and essentially she's just ordained a second time by Kato Chisan in her lineage. So she has this dual, she always had this dual history, and there are little ramifications of that. When he ordained her, there was a lot of protest, both internal and external, to Soto Shu. No foreign woman had ever trained at Sojiji. She was not welcome. He was the chief abbot, so he got his way. But a lot of effort was put to make it clear that she was not welcome there. She had a tough time. She struggled. But she eventually became head of the foreign guest department, so suddenly there were foreigners at Sojiji. But it was very difficult. It was very difficult. And when he finally transmitted her, he sent her away to open her own little temple, Unpukuji. And she did. She ran a little temple, the only foreign woman in Japan running a little temple, and eventually became recognized as a legitimate priest by the Soto Shu. They couldn't find a way out of that. I think a lot of people tried. You can read her diaries of this time. There's a lot of reason to think her diaries are not 100% accurate, but they certainly present a picture of trouble and difficulty, some of which she created, some of which was created for her. But being a foreigner actually seemed to help her after a while, because a lot of the rules that applied to Japanese women, they couldn't figure out how to apply it to a foreign woman. So she eventually did a public zuise ceremony, being officially recognized as a teacher in the Soto sect, the first modern woman to do zuise. in public. So just 5 years after she came to Japan, he died. Her protector, her defender, and her benefactor was gone. And he had encouraged her to think about going back to the West and establishing a training monastery there. And with him gone, it really became clear that she needed to find something else. So she ended up in San Francisco. It was just going to be a lecture tour with two Western disciples. But she decided to stay. And she finds this property in Northern California and founds Shasta Abbey in 1970. Shasta Abbey was founded as both a conservative and a very radical place. It was very conservative in that it was absolutely a celibate training monastery, and all of the formal traditions, the buildings were traditional, the schedule was traditional, and so on. But men and women practiced side by side, and gender had nothing to do with rank. They called her abbess. She was the abbot for 26 years and created the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives. That's her lineage. And she lived until November 6th, 1996, and died at the age of 72. So she died almost exactly when Kato Chisan died. So another reason why we do founder ceremony right now is they both died right at this time. So my teacher, Kyogen Carlson, he was born Gary, October 8th, 1948, in Los Angeles. And he grew up as a Christian Scientist, which was always pretty unsatisfying to him. In the late 60s, he found himself at UC Berkeley in the middle of the riots and the protests of the 60s, with a degree in sociology. And he was greatly affected by the tumult of those years. He had some spiritual experiences that gave him the feeling that there was more to life than this disturbance and this change. And he just really felt driven to understand the purpose of his life, the meaning of his life. So he decided to master meditation. He was going to enter contemplative life for a year and master meditation. And that was his commitment. He went to Shasta Abbey in 1972, and he said he was going to stay until he mastered Zazen. And several times he planned to leave, got ready to leave, and then just decided, well, maybe there's more. There's something else. There's a little bit more for me to learn. So he kept staying, and he stayed, and he stayed, and he stayed. He became her Jisha for 9 years, her personal attendant, and was transmitted in 1974, just 2 years after he got there. Now, it was a celibate community, but people were allowed to form relationships and marry, and he and Gyokuko fell in love and got married and were sent up here to start a satellite sitting group. And that's when I met them. After some years, our Sangha here separated from Shasta Abbey, and they became independent priests. And that was when Dharma Rain Zen Center formed. And some years after that, we formed our own order, the Dharma Cloud Order. Kyogen had more than 50 formal disciples, not Dharma heirs, but formal students, and 5 Dharma heirs before his sudden death in 2014. And a few Dharma heirs that were transmitted by others as his proxy after his sudden death, because they were in the process of moving toward that. So what do we get from these 3 lives? You know, I'm really struck when I read these stories that they all lived through really tumultuous times. They all had some significant difficulties in their practice. They all pushed against convention. They all pushed against expectations. Sometimes with a lot of difficulty, they did what was not done in several cases. And yet at the same time, they remained devoted to traditional forms, really devoted to the depth of Dharma, to the formal vows and practice that they took on. They were very unconventional in many ways, but remain very conservative in their dharma. And conservative in the sense that all three of them hearken back to our fundamental teaching, in which there are no distinctions between types of people, in which everybody has Buddha nature, everybody has a prediction. It's fundamental to our understanding of this practice that everyone is equal in enlightenment. And they all worked through their lives to make Zen available to people who had long been kept outside the gates, who had long been denied the full flower of practice. Buddhism has a very deep view of time. It's very rooted in the present, but always can look with great composure to the past, the distant past, to the distant future, and absorb that. Buddhism very comfortably inhabits this great cosmos, this unlimited, beginningless, endless cosmos. Vast numbers of worlds, vast beings, vast time, a great rising and falling of beings. And the founders of our temple, the ancestors we revere, they're our ancestors only because we came along. Teachers become teachers when a student arises. And masters become masters when disciples arise. Ancestors become ancestors when descendants appear. So we're part of that too. We're part of this Founders Day. We're part of this great reach of time. And in that sense, our whole past is our founder. Everything reaching all the way back, far beyond current memory, those are our ancestors. Because the study of lineage at its heart is studying the self. We discover the rivers of causes and conditions that bring us here today. The incredibly complex causes and conditions of our life. We didn't get here by accident. We got here through immense effects. And that's when you see that, when you see your connection to the past and you see how what came to bring you here, you realize you can't copy anybody else. You're just stuck trying to figure out what your own path is, what your life looks like, what you alone have to do, what you alone can discover. You have the chance to do this. I have the chance to do this because of others, because of the hard work of these other people. And so we honor them. But I can't be them. I can't copy them. I can only find my own way. I want to end with a quote from Dogen. This is from a brief Dharma talk he gave, collected in the Ehei Koroku. I really love these brief Dharma talks because generally they were given at the end of the day, late at night. The monks are said to, they rise and they wash and they prepare for bed, and then they come back to the hall and they stand in this flickering candlelight or lantern light while Dogen speaks for a few minutes. And I love the image of these words just landing on people. He says, "There are many kinds of knowledge. All you people who want to study the way, do so by borrowing the body and mind of Buddha ancestors. If Buddha ancestors want knowledge, they borrow your knowledge and put it to use. Therefore, breaking into a smile and attaining the true eye is the profound style of Vulture Peak. Losing our bodies and lives repays our debt of gratitude for receiving the knowledge of Buddha ancestors. Alas, for the days of the past, the teacher becomes a single piece of emptiness. Blood and tears filling my chest, to whom can I speak? I only wish that the teaching would spread widely. What is this matter of going beyond Buddhas and ancestors? So today we remember Kedo Chisan Dai Osho, great priest, Jiyu Kennet Dai Osho, Kyogen Carlson Dai Osho. And they're not really gone. It's just good for me to remember that they are out of sight. Good for me to remember that it is up to me. This temple's future is mine to do, yours to do.
If you have a question and you are in the hall, please raise your hand and say your name before you ask your question. Please hold the mic close to your mouth as well. If you are on Zoom, you can type your question into the chat or you can type your name into the chat and Tony will unmute you.
Thank you. I love history. That was great. I'm curious, what is Gyokoko's role? Is she not considered a founder, or how do we talk about her role?
That's a good question. She's still alive. She's still here, so we don't have to answer that question yet. She was not an abbot for a long time. She became the co-abbot eventually, but for many years, Kyogen was the abbot, and she was one of the priests. She didn't have that abbot's role. Then she became co-abbot. So I'm not sure what we'll do when she leaves. But she is not a founder in the same way that Kyogen is not a founder. Her teacher was alive when we started, so they were functioning on their teacher's behalf.
Thank you.
I'm Dai Guy. So you said something but didn't elaborate. And I think for maybe for other people, you said we all have a prediction. And then you went on. So, yeah.
It is predicted that every one of us will become Buddhas with our own Buddha lands and our own Buddha disciples. And the Lotus Sutra particularly is filled with these predictions, but you find them in lots of different sutras and parts of the literature, where he just will pull somebody out of the crowd and he'll say, "You, here's my prediction. You're going to be this Buddha by this name, and you're going to live in this land. You're going to have, it's going to be beautiful for these reasons, and you're, you know, and you too." And he, Devas and dragons and murderers and all kinds of people get these predictions. He's very generous. It is predictions. So that's what I mean by that. We all have a prediction. None of us are left out.
This is Amy. I just have a question about Kyogen. Like, what was he like to hang out with? Like, what kind of person was he?
How many people in this room knew Kyogen? So you'll get a different story from each one. He could be difficult. He could be a blast. He was interesting. He could be very serious and very goofy. He liked beer. He liked basketball. He liked camping. He loved Dogen. He loved study. He loved Zazen. And he was pretty much what you see is what you get with him a lot of the time. He was sincere. He was an authentic person. But he had good boundaries, really good boundaries, and I was his student for a long time before I was able to sort of move into certain kinds of intimacy with him. He was really good at keeping teacher-student boundaries. But once you knew him well, you know, there were other sides to him. Yeah.
Thanks.
Anyway, ask anybody who raised their hand and you'll hear a story. He was goofy, too.
Hi, this is Nancy. Thank you for your talk. And just bringing up that question of who is Kyogen, I'm not sure what we're doing here in this Sangha with continuing having recordings of his Dharma talks. It hasn't happened for a while. Is there a reason?
Because the person who sort of started that and was facilitating that has moved away. And if somebody wants to step up and do that, I think it could certainly happen.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a tradition or something. I didn't realize a Sangha member had...
No. It's just, for those of you who don't know, after Kyogen died, since he, the last time I saw him, which was 2 days before he died, we were standing on the subfloor of this building. Yeah. No walls. And we were walking out, where's the altar going to be, where's the kitchen going to be. So he never got to give a talk in this hall. So after he died, we played some of his recorded Dharma talks so that people could hear his voice in the hall. If somebody's really drawn to that, I mean, it's certainly something you could bring forward and see if we can find a time for more of his talks. They are available on the website.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I'm fairly new to this community, so I'm getting to understand the lineage. And for what I've read and now what I've heard, I've always wondered why this particular community decided to part ways with a bigger community.
Okay, it is kind of a complicated story, and I'm not going to go into details, but after they were married and up here, their teacher became convinced that she wanted them to come back and to no longer be married and to return to their celibate lifestyle and in several ways give up some of the independence that they had. And there's a lot of reasons why that happened. But I was part of the Sangha at that time, and it was a time of deep discernment for us. Would we become a separate, small, independent place, or would we remain part of the Shasta Abbey order? And some members went one way and some members went the other way, and it was painful, it was difficult, and Kyogen never completely reconciled with his teacher, which was difficult. But it did give him some real insight into that relationship, into the relationship between teacher and student and what it means to lead a community. So, anyway, there's lots more to the story, but that's enough for the wide group.
Thank you.
Hi, you mentioned some words or some terms in your talk I thought you could clarify. I realize I don't actually know the exact definitions. So can you tell me a little bit what like an order is and then a Dharma heir versus a disciple?
Depends on the order. An order is a line of teachers, some would say priests, who maintain the same tradition and teaching within the same body of ritual and tradition. A Dharma heir is somebody who has been given authorization to continue that order, to continue that lineage. And that authorization necessarily means you have to be able to create new people. A Dharma, a disciple here, this is very specific to us. We use the word disciple to mean someone who has taken formal vows to work with a particular teacher. It's not a requirement here. Lots of people practice here without having a formal teacher. Lots of people find that they really benefit from having a formal, sort of avowed relationship with a teacher. And none of these things are, you can become a disciple and never become a Dharma heir and vice versa. And actually, you can't become a Dharma heir without being a disciple, but they're not, there are no requirements to practice here. I think that's what I really want to say, is that the gate is pretty open.
So just to clarify then, here, the folks who are Dharma heirs are teachers.
They're the ones wearing a kesa.
Yeah.
Of whatever color. People wearing a raksu are disciples. That means that they are in a formal relationship with one of the teachers. People wearing a wagesa, which is the sash, they've taken precepts. And they've made no commitment to Dharma reign. They're part of the greater Sangha of Buddhists in the world.
Yeah. And then even though we're a separate order from Shasta Abbey because of what happened, we actually spiritually, it sounds like we are sort of in the same order. We practice. Our traditions come from there.
Yeah, we still honor them. We still sing Litany of the Great Compassionate One. We used to sing the whole service in plain song, which was great if you had good voices, and not if you didn't. But we keep singing Litany of the Great Compassionate One, in part because people love it, but also because it takes us back to that. But yeah, there's lots of things. She harked back to Dogen for a lot of things and back to Sojiji, so there's a lot of coherence. We've taken on the Soto Shu translations, which is probably the biggest change. We don't use her translations anymore.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and that's partly so that we have the we're a franchise of the Soto Shu now, so we. Sorry about that. If you're
that's a whole other Dharma talk.
If you're old enough, you remember these ads for Holiday Inn that were the Holiday Inn, the no surprise surprise. My mother loved that because you could go to a Holiday Inn and they were all exactly the same. And the fact that we chant the same thing here that people chant in other places is just kind of a way of being at home in Soto Shu. So, and we don't do it perfectly. We have a few places where we don't use those translations. Any other questions, comments?
I just wanted to thank you for your work on the book of Kyogen's Dharma Talks, which I'm getting to go through now with a group. And yeah, I just wanted to say, if anyone's curious about Kyogen, really recommend your book, or your shared book.
His book, yeah. Yeah. And one thing I was reminded of when I was editing those talks is that he was also a very elliptical speaker. His Dharma talk would start here and go over here and then go up there, and then there'd be a Leonard Cohen song, and then there'd be something about being a mover in L.A., and eventually he'd kind of come back. He had a great way of circling around, but also a very, he had a very interesting mind. Yeah. My chest fills with blood and tears. I loved him very much. So. Anything else? Oh, one more over here for Amy. And then I think we'll call it.
I'm Amy. I just want to thank you for that talk. It feels like, you know, I have a much better sense of who these people are. You know, we hear about them, but thank you for, like, giving them heart and explaining who they were to us. It means a lot. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I want them to be real. to us. They are real. Okay.